welcome to my Bob Thurman podcast. I'm so grateful some good friends enabled me to present them to you. If you enjoy them and find them useful, please think of becoming a member of Tibet House US to help preserve Tibetan culture. Tibet House is the Dalai Lama's cultural center in America. All best wishes. Have a great day.
This is episode 137, Buddhist History 101, The Three Vehicles and the Buddha's Early Life.
I think I could begin by saying that there are basically said to be three vehicles of Buddhism. And these three vehicles are known as, by me, as the monastic Buddhist vehicle, or the individual Buddhist vehicle. The second one is called the messianic Buddhist vehicle, or the universal vehicle. The third is called the tantric vehicle, or the apocalyptic vehicle. And usually they are said to have developed in India in three periods. Have you, everyone got the names of these books down that you want? I'm going to erase them. No? I'll write it later then. Three 500-year periods. The monastic vehicle Buddhism, or individual vehicle, meaning a vehicle basically designed for an individual to ride upon, to mount upon, travel on, flourished mainly for the first 500 years after the Buddha's death, which would be from around 500 before the Common Era to zero. And the emphasis was on monastic communities, and although many lay people practiced that kind of Buddhism, the sort of full-time or professional practice of it was, it was almost necessary to be either a monk or a nun. It was felt in that type of teaching. Then for the next 500-year period, the messianic vehicle, or universal vehicle, emphasized more the possibilities for the lay person, that the person without being ordained as a monk or a nun could actually advance quite a lot. And actually some people who were monks and nuns could become stuck and not advance that much. So it became a little more balanced between the path of the ordained monastic and the path of the lay person. And for about 500 years, the universal vehicle was more ascendant in India. And although during that next 500-year period, from 0 to 500 of the Common Era, the monastic vehicle was also strengthened. The universal vehicle made no effort, did not, you know, consider itself antagonistic to the monastic vehicle, but considered itself a sort of step beyond or outreach from the monastic vehicle. So the monastic vehicle was in fact reinforced by the spread of the messianic vehicle, not as it, you'll sometimes read, as if they were opposed to each other. And then from about 500 of the Common Era to about 1,000 or 1,200 of the Common Era, at which time Buddhism in India, the main country of its birth, actually disappeared due to various circumstances which we'll discuss. The most important vehicle might have been what's called the apocalyptic vehicle, or the tantric vehicle, sometimes called the diamond vehicle, the Vajrayana. And for the last 500 years, that was really important. Although, again, that vehicle made no effort to diminish the importance of either the universal vehicle or the monastic vehicle. In fact, it depended on the flourishing success of those two previous vehicles to be able to sort of deliver its service, to deliver its teaching and its message, this vehicle. Now, the reason we have to outline this right away is that those of you who are interested enough to be interested in basic Buddhism probably have encountered some form of Buddhism from some country. And you have to sort of be able to sort of understand them in terms of these three original vehicles of Buddhism. In the first 500 years, that type of Buddhism, which mainly emphasizes the monastic practice and the attainment of nirvana by the individual, nirvana meaning freedom from suffering, it spread from India first to Sri Lanka, and then from Sri Lanka to Burma, Thailand, and other parts, Indonesia and Vietnam and Laos, Cambodia, you know, Southeast Asia in general. It spread to there. And as well as, of course, spreading all around India, which was itself, India is, you know, a multinational subcontinent, and so it had spread all over India, which was quite a job. So then, well, later when Buddhism was destroyed in India, those countries preserved that earliest form of the tradition, or that what they think of as the earliest form of the tradition, and sort of not, they don't really have the later layers much. The second layer, the messianic vehicle, which remember includes the monastic vehicle, that includes the first layer, it mainly spread to Central Asia, to Iran actually, and the West. Some say as far as Mesopotamia even, and Syria. There are Buddhist edicts and Buddhist teachings written on rocks found in Syria in Aramaic language. And they sent their teachings to Greece and to Egypt. The Buddhist writers in India say, some of them. But there's not much trace of that. But anyway, it spread to the West, to Iran, to Central Asia, and then to China, and from China to Japan and Korea and those areas. So it later came to be known as Northern Buddhism, and the later, after the Indian original country, where they were all nested together, kind of the situation there changed, then that became the prevalent form of Buddhism in those countries, this universal vehicle Buddhism. And so then there's the distinction that you may have encountered between what's called Northern Buddhism and Southern Buddhism. Then the third layer of Buddhism, the apocalyptic vehicle, or the Vajra vehicle, mainly spread to Tibet, of all of the Buddhist countries. It was the main dominant form toward the end of Buddhism in India. The end of Buddhism was a little bit disturbing. It resulted mainly from foreign invasion and the destruction of Buddhist institutions and temples and so forth by these invaders. And so it was kind of a rush, the third spread, you could say. And it mainly just went up over the Himalayas into Tibet. Although there's a strand of this esoteric or tantric or apocalyptic Buddhism that goes along with northern in China and Japan. It was not quite that popular there, but there was a narrow thread of it. And actually it spread to Sri Lanka in the ancient time. But then since it was only a small thread in the later period after 1000 of the Common Era, when there was no longer that sort of matrix in India keeping them all together, the sort of majority in Sri Lanka, which were into monastic Buddhism, they said, oh, we don't want that horrible esoteric stuff, and they kind of stamped it out. They became sort of very orthodox. They said, we don't really want that. We don't need that. We don't want the universal vehicle. There was one particular monastery called Abhayagiri, the Mount of Fearlessness, in Sri Lanka that was a seat of universal vehicle and apocalyptic vehicle Buddhism, and they sort of stamped it out in the 9th, 10th, 11th centuries. So it doesn't exist in Southern Buddhism anymore. So that's kind of the history. So therefore, we have to go back to India and understand the original sort of matrix of Buddhism in India, which was its first place where it landed sort of on the planet. And then we can sort of understand how some branch of Japanese Buddhism got to be the way it was, or some branch of Indian Buddhism, so forth, various different kinds of Buddhism, which people do find so confusing. Because Buddhism, I mean, it's like Christianity. When people come and they say, I'm going to study Christianity, but then people in our religion department, they say that. People are sort of surprised, well, what do you mean? There's like hundreds of different denominations of Christianity in many different countries. There's Eastern Orthodox Christianity. There's many Nestorian Christianity. There's Armenian Christianity. I mean, there's many different kinds. Plus all the Protestants, you know, the Baptists and the Methodists, who, if you listen to them in South Texas, they're completely different. So same Buddhism is like that, and perhaps more so, because until 100 years ago, Buddhism was the majority world religion, having spread to more numbers of people in more different countries than any other religion. In this last 100 years, that status has declined drastically, and it's down about number 4 or something at this point, or number 3, I think. And which is interesting. It seems to have a good way of dissolving itself, Buddhism, but we'll get into that. Okay, so I just wanted to give you that as a basic framework. Now the three vehicles in India, Western historical scholarship tends to say about them that, you know, the monastic Buddhism was the early form of Buddhism that the Buddha himself actually taught. Then universal vehicle Buddhism was a development or elaboration from that by various individuals who then put it back in the mouth of the Buddha, but really the Buddha didn't teach it. It's something they later developed in the name of the Buddha. And then apocalyptic or tantric Buddhism is a complete fabrication that they made up. And then, but again, they put it back in the name of the Buddha, even though the way these historians teach it, both Universal Vehicle Buddhism and Tantric Buddhism are actually opposite to the teaching that the Buddha taught. But for some reason, these later fabricators, these mythical fabricators in the Western mind, a bunch of heavy forgers, you know, desperately trying to publish some bestseller or something, they think. These channelers or whoever they were, they put all these things which were the opposite meaning in the Buddha's mouth. You know, we don't really know why. They don't really know why, but they assume that's the case. The Buddhists themselves, the ones in southern Buddhism, the Sri Lanka and other places, who in the modern form of their Buddhism, they don't really have much about the universal vehicle or the tantric, and therefore they don't know much about it except for recent sort of world Buddhist conferences, this sort of thing, or meeting the Dalai Lama somewhere or something like that. Otherwise, they didn't really know about it in their own country. They tend to think that their form of Buddhism was older and more real, and the other people have sort of made something up. They tend to agree with the Western historical people. And the East Asian Buddhists, the universal vehicle Buddhists, they don't think that way about monastic Buddhism, but they are a little frightened of tantric Buddhism for the most part. They're a little scared of that. So they think, well, maybe that's something some of those Tibetans made up, you know. Up in the high altitude, their brains were starved with oxygen. They didn't have enough oxygen, and so they made up these wild visions, and they had all these women up there. They must have been very hard up for women or something in Tibet. So they have all these female Buddhas and things, and that's so the East Asian people are a bit scared of that, in fact. They are. They're polite, but they kind of look, you know. Oh, you are interested in Tibetan Buddhism? Oh, well, I see, they say. So, and they actually, some have a theory that the apocalyptic Buddhism in India, gave a much larger role to women and had female Buddhas, actually, and which, had much more attention to ritual and magic and sort of things like this, was much more widespread and popular, was taught to illiterate people, you know, spread much beyond the sort of urban educated culture that the other forms of Buddhism more appealed to, that latter form of Buddhism was therefore naturally a degeneration, a decadence. And because of that degenerate decadence of that latter form of Buddhism, that's why Buddhism disappeared in India, they say, you know, because it sort of merged with the mud and the muck, you know, it was like the lotus that grew back down into the mud or something. And they never seemed to note that the real cause of the drastic change in India at the end of the first millennium of the Common Era was the fact that India was invaded by a bunch of fanatical Muslims who burned all the temples and all the monasteries down. And then later you had a bunch of fanatical Britishers who equally didn't have much use for non-laboring men or women who would go to monastic communities. And therefore, because they wanted everybody to produce something for them, of course, which they took out in their railroad system. And so they naturally wouldn't look for the causes of this change and this decline in the activities of the Muslim conquerors and the Christian conquerors. But anyway, that's changing a little bit now. The Buddhists, the Tibetan Buddhists, and and the East Asian Buddhists to a great degree, have a different vision of the Buddha, though. And they see the Buddha himself as having taught all three vehicles and in his own day, and that you can't really say, the East Asian don't include Tantra, but they say the universal vehicle and the monastic vehicle Buddha did teach, but he taught it to different audiences, and he emphasized in that original period the monastic teaching for the larger population. And of course the monastic community became the educated, the sort of elite. They developed a university, sort of, and so they naturally recorded best the monastic teaching because they were monks and nuns. And the universal vehicle one was a little bit neglected for a few centuries until the time was ripe for it to become very, very prominent, which it did become. And then they don't include the Tantra, the East Asian people. They think that's maybe where the degeneration creeped in. The Tibetan Buddhists see all three as occurring from the Buddha's teaching, but taught in varying degrees of secrecy. You know, one was taught more publicly, one a little more reserved, one very reserved, because of the nature of the country, the development of the country. The country was very backward, really, at that time, when the Buddha lived there and first taught. And not backward because they didn't have automobiles and industrial things. They were very advanced relative to all the other countries in the world, but backward compared to where it did get to later on in its own history. India became probably, from 500 from the Buddha's time until about 1,000, until it was seriously conquered by Western invaders, India was undoubtedly the lead civilization on the planet this doesn't sit well, I know, with Westerners who are raised to think that civilization means Egypt, you know, the Holy Land, Greece, Rome, you know, Charlemagne, I guess, learning a few table manners, then the British becoming converted to Christianity and putting on, you know, Bermuda shorts and not painting themselves blue anymore, and then finally America, the supreme of civilization. So when we're used to that story, the idea that a space traveler 22,000 years ago, instead of going to Rome, first of all, he would have said, oh, Rome, that's sort of tacky looking. Bunch of emperors sitting around in the vomitorium and everything. Not too exciting. Instead, they would have gone to the great cities of India and China as well, but even more India than China. India was the wealthiest place by far. That's why everyone was always trying to conquer India. You see. And it was really very advanced and very sophisticated in its sciences, in its music, its aesthetics, its poetics. They had their Shakespeare 400 in the 400 of the Common Era, year 400 of the Common Era. Anyway, so that's a surprising thing. We can debate about that when we come to the question and answer, but it probably is the fact. And so the fact that, and this is another second shocking thing, the fact that India developed Buddhism even, so much longer before the West developed anything like Buddhism, a sort of psychology. I mean, with Buddhism, you got the equivalent of Freud and Jung and so on, 2,500 years ago, not just in 19th century Vienna. And the fact that India did develop that in the Buddhist context, in the Hindu context, had to do with the fact that India was so much more wealthy, there was so much larger a wealthy, educated class, that class, a leisure class, if you will, that like was into fooling around and experimenting and looking even at external material pleasures as well as inner spiritual pleasures, and then they developed yoga and all of these very sophisticated things that nothing like which was developed much in the West. It's not that in the Western societies or in the Chinese societies they were not individuals who were interested in such things. They were. But the authorities in the countries, because the countries were more poor economically and the authorities needed to regiment people more and the countries were more militaristic, they didn't allow those people who wanted to do yoga to sort of do it. They gave them, they would give them a quick passport out of town or hemlock milkshake, as I always say, which they gave to Socrates, remember? And Confucius never got a job, you know. He didn't. He never, not in much less tenure, he never even got a job. So it had to do with the social system in a way that so much wisdom could be cultivated, particularly about the mind, about the psyche, as was cultivated in India. And this is not just from a religious point of view, religious scholarship point of view, this is really from a sort of ethical and scientific, psychological point of view. And someone like Arnold Toynbee, that's his thesis. He talks about the 5th century before the Common Era, the Buddha's time, which is approximately the time of the pre-Socratics, and Confucius in China, Zoroaster in Iran, and reformers sort of in every culture in Eurasia. And of all of those reformers, Buddha's teaching was by far more successful, and the institution he founded was by far more successful. The kings were by far more tolerant of it. And he states that for social, basically, socioeconomic reasons. Now, when I teach these three things, Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, in these first three classes, I will try to give kind of a view from the different the perspectives of the different vehicles simultaneously, so we can sort of get to the basic Buddhist, basic essence of Buddhism, something like that. Okay, so now, where do we start? We start with the Buddha himself. The Buddha was a prince in the kingdom known as the Kingdom of the Shakyas, in the present day, what would be presently in Nepal. Their capital was in Nepal. And they were a kind of tribal confederation with a big city, according to them, although there's controversy as to just how big it really was. But in the ancient poems, they say that the capital, the palace, the spires of the palace in which the Buddha was born, were so tall that the clouds would come and float around those spires thinking that it was Mount Everest. They would get confused. They would think, well, that's the Himalayas, and they'd go to the palace instead, and they'd go around the spires of it, you know, until they got straightened out, and then they'd cruise over to the Himalayas. So, but that's probably poetic hyperbole, you know, probably wasn't quite that big. But it was quite a magnificent city, at least in the myth of the Buddha. And the myth of the Buddha is that his birth was accompanied by all kinds of prodigies and remarkable signs, even in the most humanistic form of the Buddha story. There are many forms. The Buddha story also has many forms. There are forms of the Buddha story that stress his humanity. There are those that stress his divinity. And then there are those that are sort of magical and really are more like Star Trek or Close Encounters of the Third Kind. They stress his extraterrestriality, you could say. So there's all the whole gamut of those stories. And the ones that are sort of considered more fundamental are the ones that stress his humanity. And even in those, he was still born with many magical signs and prodigies. He was born by his, he just came out of his mother's side by magic, like one of those psychic surgeons in the Philippines. There was no wound and no labor. He just came out, stood on his 2 feet, walked around a little bit, and spoke. But before his father came, once his father came, he didn't speak for a few years. He didn't want to make him nervous, it said. But at that point, he spoke with his mother and the women of her attendants, and then the gods who were there, and all the creatures of nature. He was born like Jesus, with all kinds of animals around, but it was not domestic animals. It was not in a manger. It was in a garden, and there were all sorts of wild animals around, tigers and lions and cobras and all these kind of, and dragons and goblins. And they all came. They were all hanging out. They were temporarily declared a truce. And the deer and the tiger and everybody was all together, and they were all watching the Buddha born. All the flowers bloomed out of season, and it was quite, it was a miraculous thing according to the myth. But otherwise, it's really similar to the Christ story in that respect of all the animals crowding around with delight that the Buddha was being born. You know? And all the gods came. And then he walked around, and he held up one finger like this. Again, not the normal thing that you think of as a pious religious person. And he said, he looked at everybody and everything, looked all around the universe, they say, looked at his mom, and then he said, of all beings on 2 feet, I am the supreme, he said. I'm the best, you know, that's what he said. Really funny thing to say, don't you think? And then he shut up because Dad came and he didn't want to make him nervous. And you know, there are stories of in previous lives when he was a bodhisattva, he also was born with the ability to speak. It's considered a certain sign. Certain beings are born like that, they say, in ancient time, in myths. And there are a number of stories in previous lives where the Buddha was born as the prince, and he said, hey, Dad, how you doing, type thing, when he was first born. And then the king said, what are you talking? Babies are not supposed to talk like that. Don't talk anymore. So then he didn't talk for 15 years to obey his father. You know, this was in previous life memories, stories that he told. So then he grew up. Then the soothsayers came in like geese, like flocks of geese from all over levitating, because they heard that a Buddha had been born, and they were all seeing signs and the sort of nature thing. They all came zooming into the palace. Poor Buddha's father had to feed this huge quantity of sages, and then they all were looking at the Buddha's body, which was weird, according to the ancient thing. He had like slightly webbed fingers. He had long ears. He had a sort of, the top of his head was sort of like a dome-like thing on the top of his head. He had a little tuft of white hair in his forehead. It's a third eyebrow, kind of, you know, no third eye, but a third eyebrow. And very strange, he had this rather strange body. And some other signs, there are 80 minor and 32 major signs of a Buddha. But the soothsayers were examining him thoroughly, you know, they were saying, oh, this is great, wow, they were going. And then one main soothsayer started weeping after he saw him, and then the father got very nervous. He said, what's the matter, type thing, you know? And he said, oh, don't worry, he's not a freak or anything, he's all right. I'm weeping because this boy will become a perfect Buddha at the proper age, and when he is the perfect Buddha, then beings who encounter him will find their final liberation from the suffering of all of their infinite numbers of lives in the samsara. But I am too old, and I will not live to see that. You know, he was an old sage. And so I'm weeping that my karma is such that I could only meet the Buddha in his infancy, this sage Asita said. And then he told the father this rather troublesome piece of news. He said, if he stays in the home life, he will be a world-conquering monarch. He will conquer everything between the four seas, in their old cosmology, he said. And effortlessly, he will not even have to have a war. He will just, like, send his thoughts to this and that kingdom, and they'll all surrender. There's an Indian myth about what they call a Chakravarti Raja, wheel-turning monarch. When they are crowned, a giant like wheel appears over their palace, and then this wheel just sails everywhere, and all the kings of the earth come, and they surrender, basically, to this central king. It's like a myth. That's why there's no wars during the reign or the ages of such a king. If he stays in the home, he will do like that. If he leaves the home and goes on the spiritual quest, he will become a perfect Buddha, he said. Now, you'd think that the father would want him to be, and he will become the gateway of liberation, the gateway of final freedom, of final emancipation for millions upon millions of beings. And the entire earth will be blessed and fortunate for millennia, I think. And he gave it a big sell. And then the father said, oh, I don't want that. I want him to rule the world as a king. So I'll prevent him. I will prevent him from leaving home. The father then planned, you see. And the second thing that happened that is kind of unusual about that is his mother passed away. It wasn't that she had any sort of complication and so on. It's a tradition that they have. I mean, maybe she did, but at least the way the story is told, it is a tradition that the mother of the Buddha, the woman who serves as a mother of a Buddha in any planet where a Buddha is born, she just comes there to do that job, to bring the Buddha to life, and then she leaves, because after apparently having a Buddha in your womb for 9 months, 10 months, as they say, actually, anything else would be a bore. And so she just withdraws her emanation. She's like a kind of emanation or something, and she just withdraws that and goes to a certain heaven, the equivalent of the Buddhist, the Indian equivalent of the Greek Olympus. She goes to this sort of axial heaven where the king of the gods lives, and there she has a really groovy pad and she hangs out. Until the Buddha, then he goes and teaches her there. He gives her seminars right in her palace. She's not a virgin. The Buddha's not a virgin birth like in the Christ story. But the Buddha is not conceived by the father. This is an odd wrinkle on that kind of a myth. The Buddha conceives himself in his mother's womb. He just shows up. He doesn't need the father's seed. It's never mentioned that the mother was a virgin. She was the chief queen of the king, Suddhodana. But she was on retreat. She had withdrawn from normal relations with the king for a period of religious fasting and retreat during the time the Buddha was conceived. So they say, you know, religion analysts say that kind of a myth indicates someone who's very revolutionary, either a virgin birth or some sort of miraculous birth just from the mother, sort of, because it breaks with the patriarchal line of law and custom and religion the new person is going to. So therefore, the myth of their birth has them not needing the parental seed, the male seed. You know? And so he was a father. He didn't have a normal father. Although then the father, of course, treated him as his son and tried to get him to be king after him. So then the father conceived of this plan that as long as he has a happy time all the time and never has any stress or conflict or sees anything ugly or depressing, he'll stay in the palace and then I'll get him crowned as king. And he's so virtuous, once he was formally appointed as king and ceremonially coronated, he would never leave his job. So then he'll be a world-conquering monarch and will conquer the world. It'll be great, the dad thought, proudly thinking. So he built all these palaces for him, as the myth goes. And he prevented him from seeing any sight. And he particularly, anyone who was a little bit older, he had removed from his presence. Anybody sick was, given a holiday. There was no sickness. There was no old age. Of course, death was completely unmentioned and unseen. And no childbirth, no sort of labor pains, no loud shrieks, no nothing natural like that. And everything happy, in that environment. And he had lots of girlfriends, it was arranged. And then he married fairly young, a beautiful princess he was really in love with. And actually they had a really wild love life, it is said. The two of them, Yashodhara, his wife, main wife. Those kings had large extended families. There's even one story in one of the poems of his life about how they were so carried away making love at one time on the roof of one of their pavilions that they rolled off the roof. And then landed, however, in a big thick lotus bed, and then they didn't notice they had rolled off. So all the attendants withdrew from that area, and like held up blankets or whatever. And they were having a happy time anyway. And he wasn't, he enjoyed his worldly time. But then when the time came in his late 20s, they matured very slowly apparently in that era. In his late 20s, he began to feel sort of confined in this round of constant pleasure. It was around the time that they conceived a son. He was about to have a son. And so he asked to go out and see the world. He said, I'm bringing a son into the world. I want to see more of it. I've been sitting in one place all my life. I'm getting really tired. And finally, his father agreed, and they tried to clear all the streets and clean everything, and they sort of made like a Potemkin village everywhere. But he did see in his first trip out a sick person, and then the next trip out he saw an old person, and then the next trip out he saw a corpse. In spite of all their preparations, and they said the gods arranged for him to see these, because the gods wanted, for the benefit of the universe, they wanted him to attain enlightenment. They didn't care about this world-conquering nonsense. You know, they knew how silly that was and how ineffectual. And then he saw, on the fourth trip out, he saw a monk, a seeker, a wanderer, a spiritual seeker, with a certain sort of light of calm and a light of enlightenment about him. And he asked him, what was he doing? And the guy said he was seeking freedom. He was seeking truth. And he had found something, but he had more to seek. So when the Buddha saw those four sights, they are called, the famous four sights, he then went to his father, and there are different versions of the story. In some, it coincides more or less with the birth of his son. And in others, the son is not yet born, because he goes first to the father, because by Indian tradition, when his son is born, then the father has a grandchild, then the father is the one who gets to retire from the world and then go to Florida and kind of have a vacation, and the son has to take over the kingdom until his son has a son. No, that was the royal tradition in India at that time. So the Buddha is going to be forced into the royal life if his son is born, you see, is why he goes. And or at the birth of his son, you know, he's about to be coronated, the father abdicates. So he goes and he says, Dad, he says, I don't want to be king. And Dad, I'm going to go to the woods and attain enlightenment. And then his father says, sorry, son, you are going to be king because I'm going to go to the woods and attain enlightenment. And then the son says, okay, all right, then I'll be king. Then what are my duties as a king? Well, you're supposed to see to your subject's happiness and protect them and so on. Well, okay, I have to see their happiness. What makes them unhappy? Well, what do you mean, what makes them unhappy? No. And then he says, well, I've seen what makes them unhappy. Sickness, old age, death, and an unsatisfying and unilluminating life. These things make them unhappy. Defense, taxation. This is not the main thing. These are the big things that make them unhappy. By becoming king, will I be able to help them with those problems? Well, of course you won't, he said. That's for the gods to worry about, the priests to worry about. You're supposed to be the king and fight the wars and do this. Well, I'm sorry, Dad, but that doesn't make sense, what you're telling me. I'm supposed to protect my subjects from grief and unhappiness, and the things that cause them grief and unhappiness, I'm not supposed to be able to do anything about it. It makes no sense to me. I'll tell you what, Dad, I'm going to take a break, go and meditate, seek the truth. When I find out that with which I can cure my subjects, sickness, old age, death, and suffering, I'll come back and be king, all right? So his father responded with utter logicality and said, lock him up. Which they did. They locked him up to crown him in the following day. But then he escaped. He went AWOL. Cut off his hair, took off all his jewels, put on the rags from a corpse, and wandered off for 6 years to do asceticism and fasting and meditating and studying with different gurus. And everyone was really upset. His wife particularly was very upset. She said, I can go with him. Why didn't he take me? He's my husband. I love him. He loves me. He's going to go find the truth, and I should go with him. And besides, we should take our little boy along too. She was very upset. He really was quite mad. After he became a Buddha, she wouldn't see him, wouldn't talk to him for quite a while. Eventually, she became the head of the order of nuns, of course. But for a long time, she resisted the fact that he had become a Buddha. So, and his father's heart was more or less broken by that. Until he met him later. Then he became quite happy, actually. So then he went to the woods, and he meditated very hard for 6 years. He starved. He became an ascetic. But I have to say one thing about... I don't know, how many of you saw Mr. Bertolucci's movie? That was really not very well done. I'm sorry. That was one of the things that annoyed me very much. The five ascetics who were with the Buddha during his period of extreme asceticism were not this kind of funky old freaks, you know, with like some all the things and all long grubby fingernails and looking all twisted and distorted. Like, you do have those kind of old sadhus in India, but those particular five were young princes from the Shakya kingdom who were his own age and who were following him as his followers, you know, and they were not at all, they became funky as he did by fasting and becoming skinny and long hair and all this. But they were not this kind of like really circus show freak sort of thing that Bernardo felt it would really titillate the Western audience. That was really cheap of him. He knew it perfectly well. It was in all his accounts. But he couldn't resist these really funkadelic like siddhas, you know, which really gave a false impression really of what was going on. Anyway, they did a lot of sort of athletic yoga and deep concentration. And the Buddha reached to the point actually where he was giving up everything. He was even giving up breathing. And he was doing a yoga of cataleptic trance where he didn't breathe anymore. he got into this thing, he kind of made a vow, like, I'm not going to draw any more breath until I have become a free and perfectly benevolent being. I will not take even air until the air that I take will be only recycled through me for the benefit of all beings. When it's just gulped down in selfish ignorance, I won't even breathe it. And he was sitting there, and then there are various versions of what happened, but in the one I like, the tantric version, this fantastic goddess showed up called Buddha Lochana, the Buddha eye, the eye of all the Buddhas. And she said, well, Siddhartha, my young friend, what are you doing? And she said, you'll only choke yourself like that, she said. And then she snapped her fingers and said, and then his astral body left, the body that was there in cataleptic trance, his magic body left, and she took him up into this Akanishta heaven, a place where all the Buddhas congregate, and then he was initiated into the mandala, this and that, and then he turned golden from that time. Anyway, that's one version. In another version of the story, he himself understood the futility of this sort of excessive self-mortification, and he realized that it was just the opposite extreme of his self-indulgence that he had conducted himself with in the palace life, you know, every pleasure and every sense experience that could be imagined. And this was still a kind of inverted self-obsession, obsession with the body, and it itself would not lead to enlightenment. So he should come back to a middle way between those two extremes. So he then left his five companions who condemned him for it. They said he chickened out, you know, he's not a good ascetic anymore. And because they were, you know, when you do that kind of fasting, you get into all these supernormal phenomena, and you kind of go into a super trip, you know. And they said he's chickened out, and he's had, you know, he's gone off, and he's eating food and all this, and he's like, he's cut his hair, he's bathing. What a bum, you know. But anyway, some local village girl brought him a bowl of this exquisite rice and everything, and he began to eat, and he washed himself. His body, he filled out immediately because it was sort of magic time because he was coming close to Buddhahood, and his body filled out. He turned golden, and this great ray of golden light shone all over the world. It's been a very amazing time, supposedly, according to the myth. And then he walked a little bit here and there, and then he went under this tree in the place called Bodh Gaya, and he sat down under the tree, and he said, now I'm going to sit here, and then, you know, and I won't get up until things really are clear to me, and I'll eat and whatever, but I'm going to stay here. And then the earth shaked and quaked and all this kind of things. And then he spent several days there, and then one long day and a night. And at the end of that, in the morning, in the early dawn, before the dawn, before the sunrise, it is said he attained this. In the early part of the night, he attained the memory of all of his former lives. He remembered that he had been living infinitely, and he remembered himself as being all different types of forms of beings. He remembered when he was a dinosaur and a dragon and an amoeba, when he was on this other planet as a slime sludge pile. He remembered every single form of existence that he had, infinite numbers of forms of existence. And so he sort of understood his connection to all life, and he understood the biology of life. He understood how the individual goes from life to life through the great chain of being in the Darwinian sense, and even going beyond the human form to divine forms, and then going way below the animal form into lives in hell, into what is called the Pretaloka, the sort of cosmos that he saw. And he realized his identity with all those kinds of beings that he had lived all those lives. And he realized then the human life, what it represented in relation to all that sort of biology. And then in the second watch of the night, he had a similar vision about all other beings. And he saw the situation of all the other beings and all of the times, millions and billions and endless times they had been reborn. How lucky they were to now have become human, those who he knew around him as humans. And which animals who had previously been human had lost the human form, and the different destinies of the gods. And he became completely clairvoyant about all the destinies of all other living beings. And he felt filled with compassion for all of them, in fact. And able to read all their thoughts and know all their inner minds and anxieties and agonies and so forth, and know their experiences from hell and all this kind of thing, and the insatisfactoriness of their experience in the heavens. And this filled him with great compassion about all beings. And then finally, in the last watch of the night, it said he went through what is known as the 12 links of the chain of dependent origination, and he understood the causation of himself, of all things, and how the world was caused, and how the world was, in fact, unmade, how the world can be unmade, and how the world of suffering, and how, in fact, the world can be remade into a world beyond suffering, a world of joy and bliss. And he understood all of that. It was called the wisdom of the cessation of suffering he achieved. and in the pattern of the 12 links of dependent origination, just to make a note of that, I'll explain it to you, and the pattern of the four, what are called the four noble truths later, he gave us the pattern of that understanding. And so in the meantime, this god, known as, there was a particular god called Mara, the evil one, Mara Papiyan, and who is like Satan, really. He's the Satan figure. In fact, he is the model for Satan, they say. 500, remember, this story is 500 years before the Christ story, 5 centuries before. And but he's not, he doesn't live in a hell realm. He lives in heaven, a very fancy kind of, you know, Las Vegas-type heaven. Really, like incredible. And he has all kinds of, like, casinos and, like, things, you know, pleasure palaces of every kind. And his role is to tempt people. And he particularly doesn't like, the other gods rely on him. When any human gets too powerful and too insightful, and the gods feel it sort of threatens their power, they send Mara down there to tempt him and get him to, like, or her, and get them to just fool around and give up their quest, you see. So Mara came down, and sort of first he tried to entice the Buddha. He brought down about 12,000 dancing girls from his palace, not two or three like in Bertolucci, some two or three scrawny ladies. He brought thousands of them, and they put on a huge performance, and the Buddha just sort of smiled at them and didn't really, you know, he wasn't into it. And so then they all turned mean, and he brought troops and armies, and they threw mountains at him, and they did all this stuff, and all of that turned to flowers and created a big heap of flowers all around. So then Mara was unable to get him with either fear or lust, and then he tried to confuse him, and he came and he offered him worldly power, and he did very like the Gethsemane story with Christ and Satan. But he tried one little wrinkle which was different, and he said, he tried to make him feel guilty for being proud or something like that, and he went and said, look, what is it? Who asked you to become this Buddha, you know, Mara said. He came up and said, okay, you resisted my temptations, you resisted my aggression. But, you know, on the other hand, like, what is this big deal? Like, I'm going to be a Buddha, and I'm going to save all beings. I mean, who asked you, you know? By what right do you proclaim that you're going to become a Buddha, you know? I mean, what's the big deal, you know? Aren't you, like, a bit puffed up and arrogant? I'm going to be Buddha and save all beings. What is this? So then Buddha said, well, how did you get to be Mara, the king of the gods of the heaven of that is without contention, the Arana heaven, the heaven without strife? And he kind of said, well, you supposedly know everything, you tell me. So he said, yeah, I'll tell you, okay. When the one time when you were down in this one hell and you were, you know, you offered some water to some fellow demon there as you were torturing people, you know, on the rack or over some roasting them alive on some flame. You actually had a little cool water, it was hot, thirsty work, you know, torturing people. So you offered a drink, a sip of your water to one of your neighboring demons. And that little bit of kind of consideration of that thirst of your fellow there, that tiny bit of altruism, created one little seed of goodness in all of your evil past. And from that little seed of goodness, you rose until you became the king of the gods of the pleasure palace heaven. So Mara was shocked. Well, he was clairvoyant to that degree, and he realized he knew that was true himself. So he said, well, okay, so you're my witness, he said then. So you're the witness of my virtue. Who is your witness, he said, because, you know, no one else was around, you know. And he didn't know all of Buddha's previous lives. So who's your witness? You know? And the Buddha said, oh, the Mother Earth is my witness. It's the original environmentalist. You know? So he put his hand down on the ground. If you see statues of the Buddha, the one hand is down like that. You know, one is flat on his lap in the meditative thing, but one is down, he's putting it on the ground. And he's calling the Earth to witness, it's called. And then Mother Earth came hopping out, emanating herself in the form of 16 goddesses, who stood around all in the trees and started reciting nonstop all of the millions of previous lives of the Buddha, called the Jataka stories, in sort of multimedia presentation, you know. And Mara went, you know, zounds, drat, you know, and he went away because, you know, the Buddha had, when he was a rabbit, he went and he jumped in the frying pan because when the hungry traveler was there, when he was lassie, he saved all the people from this, when he was the king and there was a famine, he fed everybody with his blood. When he was he gave his eyeballs to the blind people. I mean, there's nothing the guy didn't do by way of virtue. In fact, I used to have a Sanskrit teacher who hated Buddhism, or he didn't really, but he pretended to. And he used to tell me, he used to say, Bob, how can you stand that Buddhist literature? I said, what do you mean, Danny? He said, well, there's such a bunch of goody-goodies. He said, I can't take it. They never do anything wrong. They're always giving everything and doing the right thing and tolerating everything without anger. It's so boring. He said, I want to see them do something mean. He said. So So I said, well, you want to maybe in literature, Dan, I used to tell him, but I'm sure you're happy if you ever meet one that they don't do it to you. He said, yeah, well, I guess you're right.
Interstitial music provided by Tenzin Chogyal. Used with the artist's permission, all rights reserved. To learn more, visit tenzinchogyal.com. This podcast is made through the generous support of the Tibet House U.S. membership community and listeners like you. To learn more about the benefits of Tibet House membership, please visit tibethouse.us. For a complete listing of all upcoming Robert Thurman events, please visit bobthurman.com. And for upcoming events in the heart of the Catskills in Phoenicia, New York at Menla, please visit menla.us, located just 2 hours north of New York City.